from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. In this first half hour, we'll talk about the closely watched special election in Georgia last night, the most expensive campaign for the House of Representatives in history. Republican Karen Handel defeated Democratic challenger John Ossoff. Then at 10:30, Uber CEO Travis Kalanick has resigned. Shareholder pressure and months of scandals set the stage for his exit. We'll discuss how this will change Uber's prospects. It's all coming up after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Yesterday, Republican Karen Handel defeated Democratic challenger John Ossoff in a closely watched special election in Georgia. It was the most expensive election in U.S. history for a House seat, drawing wide national attention as Ossoff raised more money from California than from his own state of Georgia. Republicans have held the seat for nearly four decades, but Democrats hope anti-Trump sentiment could flip the district blue. Joining us to discuss the election, NPR's political reporter Jessica Taylor, who's with us from the nation's capital. Welcome.
Hi there.
Hi, good to have you. I also have Johnny Kaufman with us from Atlanta, reporter with public radio station WABE in Atlanta. Welcome. Good morning to you.
Hello.
Hello. It's actually good afternoon in Atlanta, but glad to have you both with us. And Johnny, let me begin with you. This was not as quite as close as it was predicted to be, actually, was it?
Yeah, that was the biggest surprise for us here. We expected to be, you know, up very late last night as the results came in, and in the end, it turned out that, you know, Handel repeated history. This has been a Republican district for a generation, and it stayed that way last night pretty easily.
Well, but how much of it was seen? I mean, you know, there was a lot of talk about it being vital for both parties. How much of it was seen as a referendum either for or against Trump?
You know, when you talked to Democrats on the ground here, especially many of the volunteers, and there were a lot of volunteers for the Democrat Ossoff's campaign, they talked about Trump all the time. And they talked about the happenings in Washington, the debate over health care that's going on right now. But the Democrat candidate, Ossoff, he avoided talking about Trump. His message was, you know, be kind, sort of just like a let's be nice kind of message. But, you know, in the hopes that Democrats would read into it, he is sort of talking about Trump, but he's not talking about Trump. Because remember, this is a super Republican district, and he had to draw in those Republican voters as well.
Well, there was quite a campaign. I mean, $50 million roughly spent, again, breaking all records, although it should be noted, Nate Cohen noted this, that this is the sixth most educated district in the United States, and only about one of 15 where half the people have college degrees. So we're not talking about backwoods Georgia people here or anything, you know, out of Deliverance or anything along those lines. Let's talk just for a moment with you, though, if we could, Johnny, about the campaign itself, because it was saturated with ads. And I'd like our listeners to hear one of those ads, which was, shall we say, San Francisco-centric.
Hi, Georgia. San Francisco just wanted to say thank you.
We already have Nancy Pelosi as our congresswoman. Now you're going to give us John Ossoff as our congressman.
We're proud that California is the leading funder of the John Ossoff campaign.
He's one of us.
We're really excited that John Ossoff likes higher taxes.
Pelosi and Ossoff will weaken the military. ISIS? They're overrated.
San Francisco loves them some John Ossoff.
Congressional Leadership Fund is responsible for the content of this advertising.
And you can't see that ad, but there were a lot of hippie-looking and people of color and so forth. I mean, it was an appeal to the Trump base, clearly, but it was also an appeal to those who might not like San Francisco values and Nancy Pelosi.
For sure. And the Republicans really tried to paint Ossoff as an outsider in the district. And they had a lot of ammunition to do that because he actually does live outside of the 6th District, although he grew up there and spent a lot of time
there. Well, he's living there temporarily because of his fiancée. Right?
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. But, you know, when I talked to Republican voters on the ground, people who would have voted for Handel even if Ossoff did live in the district, that was definitely something they talked about. You know, how the heck can this guy who doesn't even live here, doesn't know us, is a Democrat. Remember, these people have grown and lived in that district, a very Republican district. You know, how the heck can he come in here and tell us what's best for us?
Again, Johnny, go ahead, finish your thought. I'm sorry, I thought you...
Yeah, and so I think that, you know, it might have not... It definitely did, like as you said, motivated people to get out there and was a way for... the Republicans to really just draw a contrast between Ossoff and Handel.
Again, Johnny Kaufman with us from Atlanta, reporter with public radio station WABE in Atlanta, and Jessica Taylor's NPR political reporter with us from the nation's capital. This is, what does it mean in terms of control of the House that's in play here that people have been saying all along is in play, as you see it, Jessica?
Well, I think that, you know, this is just one of 435 seats, and November 2018 is a long time away, over 16 months away. And certainly I think things can shift. But what Democrats did need to do, you know, they've had marches against Trump. They've had protests. They've come close in these other special elections in Kansas and Montana, and then even South Carolina last night was much closer. But what they haven't done yet is put a win on the board. And I think just, you know, a moral victory in a way, too, of saying, OK, we did something, we captured something. And when you look at just the pure numbers of it, this was their best shot because this was a district that really rapidly changed in the 2016 election. You mentioned that this is a very highly educated district. This is not Trump country, even though this is a traditional Republican district that Price, the now HHS secretary, won very comfortably.
Excuse me. It's also Newt Gingrich district, isn't it?
Right. Parts of it were before. It's changed a lot in redistricting, but there are parts of the district that Newt Gingrich did represent at one point. Yes, they're in Cobb County and different things. But, you know, this is Republican territory, really. But they thought that, you know, because these people had not voted for Trump, they did not vote for him in their primary there either, that they might have a chance to flip this. And so, as Johnny said, you know, it's interesting because Ossoff, he started out sort of messaging. He had this sort of make Trump furious message, but he kind of backed away from that. And I think that what it showed, too, is that ultimately these traditional Republican voters, even if they're not crazy about Trump, they are willing to, I think, vote for a more traditional candidate. And we also saw that some of Democrats, you know, tried and true attack ads like the Pelosi one that we just heard is still a really effective message. So I think that Democrats, they've got to, I think, you just try to find a message heading into 2018. And I think it's clear that just this anti-Trump message isn't going to be maybe as effective as they thought.
Well, I had Congresswoman Pelosi on the air with me on Monday, and I asked her, because Romney won this district by 23 points, Trump only by 1.5 or so. So the Democrats thought they really had a shot with the anti-Trump rhetoric. But the Democrats have been very split, too. I mean, the Bernie supporters versus, shall we say, the more Obama traditional Democrats. And how much did that play into this? And how much does it continue to play into this inability of the Democrats to get a win on the board?
One thing I was shocked by when I was down there for the runoff back in April and talking to people that were Ossoff supporters out canvassing for him, he sort of had this ability to sort of be all things to all Democrats. You know, I talked to people, they're like, he's a centrist. I really like that about him. And, you know, or so I talked to another volunteer and they'll be like, he's a progressive. I was hardcore for Bernie and I'm hardcore for him. So he didn't say things one way or the other that was really alienating to sort of either wing for the party. And I think if he had have won, I think it would have been maybe a good message and a good sort of blueprint for Democrats across the board. But we are sort of seeing some finger pointing the day after, you know, both from, you know, people that maybe want Democrats to have a different message, but even from some more liberal Democrats. Democracy for America came out with a statement sort of saying that, you know, if he'd have run on more of a progressive platform, that this could have helped him. So you are still seeing that, you know, warring sort of factions within the party. But, you know, while he really sort of became the only game, not just in town, but in the country, really. That's why you saw these people that were upset with Trump sending money to him, sending these small dollar donations. And that's why he was able to raise upwards of $23 million for his campaign.
Well, as I pointed out to Nancy Pelosi, he was against single payer. He was against corporate tax on the rich. And he was not necessarily all that vociferous, to put it mildly, against Trump. But let me go to what really is top concern here, remaining top concern, and that is health care. How does this affect what the Republicans are brewing up in secret here to try to replace the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare?
I think that if Ossoff had won, I think it really would have been a major setback because we're expected to see the Senate bill come out tomorrow. And again, as you mentioned, they're doing this large enclosed door sessions. We don't know what's in it. We don't know what's going to come out of it. which, of course, is the same thing that they criticized Democrats for, how they approached this in 2009 and 2010. And, you know, I think that would have really sort of been a major blow. But, you know, it also really, as I think Johnny mentioned as well, you know, for all of the talk of nationalization, I mean, from people I talked to on the ground, this really wasn't a major, you know, it would come up certainly in debates and different things, too. But you didn't see a lot of people running. They weren't running ads on this or things, too. So, you know, for now, I think that it... Republicans have sort of dodged a bullet in that way, that it can go forward and maybe even helps them a little bit. But, you know, it's over, I think over across the board, we look at polling and the AHCA, the American Healthcare Act that the Republican House put out, still remains very unpopular, but it is very much a base issue that also Republicans sort of had double-edged sword that Republicans are able to motivate their voters to turn out for at least some Obamacare repeal. But now, of course, the onus is on Republicans for, okay, you want to repeal and replace it. You've been talking about this for 8 years. How are you going to do it?
We're talking about yesterday's election in Georgia, and we do want to hear from you. We're talking with Jessica Taylor, NPR political reporter, and Johnny Kaufman, who reports for public radio station WABE in Atlanta. And please feel free to join us with your thoughts and your comments and any questions you might have. You can do that by calling our toll-free number right now. That number is 866-733-6786. Again, the number for your calls, 866-733-6786. It's toll-free. You can also post any comments on our website or our Facebook page or email us at our new email address, kqedtalk@gmail.com. That's kqedtalk@gmail.com. Or feel free to tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. And I'm going to go to your calls and emails here forthwith. Just quickly back to you, though, if I could, Johnny Kaufman. He's a 30-year-old guy, sort of maybe trying to be too many things to too many people and perhaps even too tepid in his campaign?
Yeah, he was definitely playing up, trying to make himself appear as someone who is very polite, kind. And as Jessica, you know, pointed out, he was kind of a blank slate for Democrats to project their ideas, what they wanted to see in a candidate, you know, on him, this nice guy, really trying to contrast his tone with the tone that we hear from President Trump and the tone in Washington right now. But, you know, it's hard when you have so many supporters who are so riled up and yet you are so calm. And he almost at times seemed very robotic. He was so on message. And we, as reporters in gaggles, we were surrounding him, trying to get him to kind of loosen up and show a little bit personality. And it was really hard. You know, that maybe was his strategy, though, to just be kind of the blank slate so that people could see him as they wanted to see him.
And a quick comment, and if I could go to you on this, Jessica, and get a response from one of our listeners who says, this is a Pelosi fail. Harry Reid and Pelosi consistently snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. Leaders need to be from middle America to resonate.
That's a lot of what you're hearing from, you know, sort of more rank and file Democrats today, you know, that maybe Democrats missed the message of 2016. They lost in these Rust Belt states. It was really interesting last night when all of this was coming in. You had a tweet that came from Seth Moulton, who is a Massachusetts Democratic member of Congress. But, you know, he said, you know, race should be a wake up call for Democrats. Business as usual isn't working. Time to stop rehashing 2016 and talk about the future that they need a new message. And interestingly enough, he was a very strong supporter of Ohio Congressman Tim Ryan, who was, of course, the main challenger to Pelosi in last year's leadership elections. And you did sort of have a very small minority of the Democratic caucus that did sort of want sort of new blood. And Ryan comes from these places that Democrats did not do well in 2016. So a lot of people did think maybe a new face out there, that he's from this blue collar district, Rust Belt. This is sort of where Democrats need to do well with. But then Pelosi, she does just have this grasp on the party. I mean, she is still their biggest fundraiser. She, you know, obviously has secured her place in history as the first female speaker of the House. And they do have a shot, even this race aside, the House very much is still in play. There are ways that this can happen. And with the numbers that we see historically with a president's party losing seats in a midterm election, especially with a president whose unpopularity is this high, there is absolutely a path for Democrats to take back the House. But I think what you're seeing already happening, you know, less than 24 hours after this, or sort of excuse me, finger pointing, and some Democrats saying, you know, we told you so, that if you run Pelosi, Republicans are just going to run these ads over and over, and she is a motivating factor. Maybe let's remove this and get some new blood in there. But whether that will happen, I think that's still a long shot.
Well, let me bring our callers into this. And Tamron, you're first up. Good morning, Tamron. Welcome.
Hey, Michael. So I just know with the national election, there was a lot of concern about voter suppression, you know, especially in states like Arizona, and redistricting has been a big thing. I just wonder in the Georgia election if there's any evidence that, you know, there might be disproportionate representation of certain people.
Yeah, it's an important question because it did come up. What do we know, Johnny Kaufman, if anything, on that score?
So far, you know, we haven't heard any reports of any of that on election day or, you know, in the early voting process or anything like that. I will say, though, that there was a case here earlier. At first, the state was not allowing people who were not already registered before the first round of this election to vote in the second round. But that a federal judge overturned that, eventually opening up things for people to register. And Jessica hinted at the gerrymandering issue a little bit. To address that, actually, you know, it's kind of a funny situation where when this district was drawn the latest time, it was drawn in a way to de-emphasize some voters in one county. And in the end, last night, actually, those voters in Cobb County actually ended up benefiting the Republican candidate. And this was a district that was drawn by Republicans. So it's a little bit confusing to just, you know, say that this was about gerrymandering. Certainly that happens in Georgia, but we don't have any sort of direct evidence that influenced the result of this election.
And here's Todd, our next caller. Todd, join us.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to make more of a comment. I guess I'm a little surprised about the discussion being, you know, that it was a surprise to everybody that a red county and a red state voted red. I mean, I don't know. It's just a little odd to me. I mean, for me, you know, just I've come from the Bay Area and I've lived in parts of the South and in more progressive areas of the South, but it's so night and day from what you can call San Francisco. You know, I mean, it's just like tying anything to the Bay Area in that part of the country is just going to set you up for failure. I mean, it's still nowhere near where, you know, California in a state is, and certainly nowhere near where San Francisco is a state or a city is. So I'm just a little like surprised why everyone was so surprised that it went red so fast. I mean, you know.
Well, it's a traditionally red conservative area, Todd. Your point is well taken. But the polls were showing that it was supposed to be a very close race, although it turned out not to be quite as close as was anticipated vis-a-vis the polls, which brings me to another question, if I may. For you, Jessica Taylor, you had mentioned South Carolina earlier. This was not as close as we expected. South Carolina was closer than expected. What can we glean from that?
So I was pretty shocked by that because, you know, I certainly thought that the Republican Ralph Norman there would win. I spent just one day sort of doing a story there when it was the primary. And you had the Democratic candidate there, Archie Parnell, who is just kind of a quirky, unique guy. He was a tax attorney. He worked for Goldman Sachs. He kind of played up in his ads sort of his nerdiness, you know, talking about like, I really like the tax code. I'd like to help reform it. His ads were really good. And, you know, you had very low turnout there, which I think helped him too. But, you know, Democrats did not spend money here. The DCCC, the House arm of the Democrats, put in a very, very small amount of money to help turn out African-American voters in the district. But again, this is a place where, like Kansas, if Democrats had gone in and helped them and helped this candidate, I think it would have had a negative backlash because, again, it makes it a national race. You can point, he's tied to the national party. He would do things with the national party. And, you know, I don't think it would have helped. So, you know, while it looks close, getting those final 3 points in a district like this South Carolina district is very, very hard. And I think that if Democrats had gone in there and spent any money, I think it could have even been, you know, maybe a bigger victory for Republicans in the end. But to get to the caller's point, too, I think there is something to glean from that as well, because it is a red area, and I think the Democrats maybe underestimated how much they spent there. That it, I think, you know, I heard one thing bandied around called sort of Ossoff fatigue, and I think that people maybe just got tired of hearing these ads, seeing these ads. There was just saturation there in the Atlanta media market, and you know, even when I was there in April for the runoff, people, I was shadowing some door canvassers. Everyone at the door, they were like, "Please stop knocking on my door. Please stop calling me." And this was in April. There were still two more months to go because no candidate got to 50%. And so I think that, you know, the way that Democrats played in here, too, and put so much money in, I think that obviously ended up maybe being a bit of a backlash in Georgia as well.
Jessica Taylor, political reporter for National Public Radio. Let me read a couple of your comments. Victor writes, "It was a close race in a traditionally Republican stronghold. I say nice work and keep the pressure on." And John writes, "Yet more hypocrisy from liberal California. It got so indignant when Utah spent money on Proposition 8, yet Hollywood and Silicon Valley money have no problem meddling in other states' elections. No doubt this is not the only election California money has made its way into." And let me bring on some more of your calls. Let me go next to Keith. Good morning. You're on the air. Keith, are you there? One more time. Keith?
Hey, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. There certainly is a lot to unpack here. I've been involved in Democratic politics all across the country for the last three decades, and let me tell you, this guy was never going to win in Georgia, and the Democrats, it wasn't even close. The fact that you had to spend $30 million to get it within 3 points is awfully telling. I'm sure a lot of his messaging was poll-tested, and that's why he came off as robotic when he's delivering all of his messages. Looks like a nice young guy with a articulate delivery, but the Democrats— this was a dismal failure in my estimation. The Democrats have to stop acting from a point of desperation. Now they have a narrative that they're battling of being desperate to try to win one of these things. You have to pick your battles, and there's only so many resources to go around. That $30 million could have picked up a half dozen congressional seats around the country, or it could have gone towards that. We've got legislatures and caucuses, Democratic caucuses, we got to try to win back. That money and those resources could go into those efforts. Pick up a few gubernatorial, governor seats around the country. It's really a matter of looking at your resources, allocating them correctly, coming up with the right narrative and the right messaging, and picking your battles. And the Democrats are failing to do that, and they're going to continue to miss the mark if they continue to act out of desperation.
All right, Keith, I thank you for that call. And in fact, I'm looking at another comment here and a tweet from Carl, Jessica, that says, why no more Democratic money in South Carolina? Might that have made a more valuable long-term shot across the bow?
Well, like I said, I do think that it sort of would have had a sort of reverberation, that sort of negative impact too there, because if this becomes a national election in South Carolina, it's the same thing. I think that if they had seen Parnell as tied more to the national party, then it would have hurt him more. The very small amount of money that they did put in was targeted to African-American turnout. That's something that could be beneficial down the line, but it's the same thing. You know, those last 3 points, those last 2 points within the margin, that's the killer. And I think that, Democrats may be wishing that they have, certainly maybe wishing they have some of that Georgia money back, certainly, but I don't think that in South Carolina it would have made that much of a difference either.
Well, we'll leave it there. And my thanks to you, Jessica Taylor, political reporter for NPR. Thank you for joining us, Jessica. Glad to have had you.
Thank you.
And thanks to Johnny Kaufman from Atlanta, reporter with public radio station WABE. Thank you, Johnny.
You're welcome.
And thank you, our listeners. We are coming up on another segment of Forum. We're going to talk about the resignation of Travis Kalanick of Uber in the segment ahead. Stay tuned for that. It's right up ahead. I'm Michael Krasny.